For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
You know, coming in a bit late because I heard that the session went late, but we do have very limited time here, so I think I'm going to go ahead and get going anyway. My name is Alice Ott, for those of you who have not been in, either with the class or were in the first session. I am an affiliate professor of the History of Missions and Global Christianity at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. We are coming today in our story of the history of missions to Pietist and Puritan missions. Actually, I have Pietist first. We're going to talk about Puritans first. And we're getting at this point, basically when we talk about the Protestant Reformation, we are going to see a glaring lack of missionary activity. Now, for those in the class, have they read some reasons why that could be the case? But we are going to see in this session, and actually in tomorrow morning's session, the first beginnings today that we're talking about among the Puritans and the Pietists. More specifically, they were greater involved in the Puritans. In tomorrow morning session, that's also a workshop, we're going to be looking at some preparatory issues that needed to be resolved to launch in a big way the modern missions movement, William Carey and so forth. And so that's going to be Evangelical Revival and Missions tomorrow morning. But today we're going to be talking about the beginnings of Protestant missions among the Puritans and Pietists. Well, we all assume we know what Puritanism is. But my experience is we actually have a harder time with that definition than we often know. Someone want to give me a one-sentence definition of what Puritanism is?
They wanted to purify the Anglican Church from the priests of Catholicism.
There you go. That's good. So Puritanism is a reform movement. It is a mocking, derogatory term initially. They were Puritans, the ones who wanted to purify the Church of England, their English church government, as well as their liturgy of popery. Now, that's the word they used back then. We're not talking about that good-smelling stuff you put in bowls on your table. We're talking about Roman Catholicism, which they are going to call popery. So that is what it is. It took place at a specific era from basically the 1560s. That's when the Puritan movement arose under Queen Elizabeth I in England. And it's going to have an end in the 1680s, end of the 1680s, because there's an edict of toleration. The Puritans are going to then move into nonconformist forms of denominations in England. So in England, it has that historical stand. But Puritanism is more than that. Often the way we use it is as a distinctive style of piety and theology. The theology, of course, Reformed or Calvinistic theology, strong emphasis on the sovereignty of God, that mankind is all entirely dependent upon God for all aspects of salvation. Emphasis theologically on the authority of the Bible and so forth. So that's its theology. But particularly, I'm talking English Pietism, also New England Pietism, Puritanism, sorry, there are other distinctive aspects of piety involved. One was Sabbath keeping. We'll see this reflected in England under James I. Book of Sports is going to reflect James going against this desire of the Puritans to keep the Sabbath, in other words, Sunday, holy. They were not only called Puritans. This is something many of you may not know. They were referred to as Precisians. Anyone heard of that before? Okay, I thought so. It's not as well known, and basically Precisians means that they were concerned about holy living. They had, if you read Lewis Bailey's Practice of Piety, it's going to have very strong and detailed examples of how to live a holy Christian life. So that's going to be part of it. There's going to be a very different Puritan writers, such as William Perkins, William Ames, are going to build a taxonomy of conversion, which is going to view conversion as a complex and generally long process in the person's life. Other thing are going to be, this will come up more in New England Puritanism, public fast, prayer meetings. They're not under the, they have freedom to do it the way they want to in the New World. And lastly, an emphasis on covenants, the individual covenant of salvation. Churches in New England would covenant together to form a church, the church covenant. And there would be national covenants that that God would enter into covenants with nations, and if they kept the covenant, that would lead to blessing. If they failed to do so, judgment. So that is a brief definition of Puritanism. Sorry, I hope I don't keep going, getting my Puritanism and Pietism wrong here. Let us move on to what we're really talking about, and that is Puritan missions in North America. Well, when we come to this subject, we are going to see that the charters of both the Plymouth Colony and the Massachusetts Bay Colonies are going to explicitly state that one of the goals of these colonies was to spread the gospel to the Native American populations. Now, they are specifically, if you, John Winthrop, the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, is going to point out that they were tired of Roman Catholic boasting that they had been involved in missions since the, 1492, and that, to kind of shut their mouth about their boasting for what the Catholics had done in terms of mission. John Winthrop is going to say that their mission would, quote, remove the scandal to our religion that we show not as much zeal in seeking the conversion of the heathen as the papists do. Roman Catholics, papists. And so that was a clear desire. It was clearly listed. If you read William Bradford's Of Plymouth Plantation. Very interesting. Pull it out before Thanksgiving sometime. And read about the Plymouth Plantation. He is going to clearly state that one of the many reasons, there was more than one, for coming to the New World was to, I'll read it for you. Lastly, and which was not least, a great hope and inward zeal of laying some good foundation, or at least of making some way thereunto, for the propagating and advancing of the gospel of the kingdom of Christ in those remote parts of the world, yea, though they should be but even as stepping stones unto others for the performing of so great a work. So a desire to at least lay a foundation in reaching the Native American populations. Massachusetts Bay, they're not going to be much different. John Winthrop, once again, the first governor, is going to say that their desire was, quote, to draw the natives of this country to the knowledge of the true God. And even more clearly is in their charter of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Would someone like to read it? It has the, I left it with the old spelling. But it's still clear what it is. Somebody? Okay, Dan?
Charter of Massachusetts Bay Colony, whereby our said people, inhabitants there, may be so religiously peaceable and civilly governed as their good life and orderly
conversation.
may win and incite the natives of country to the knowledge and obedience of the only true God and Savior of mankind and the Christian faith, which in our royal intention and the adventurer's free profession is the principal end of this plantation.
Okay. So they're going to say that the principal end of this plantation company is to win and incite the natives to the knowledge and obedience of the only true Savior. Okay, that's the crucial part of the line. Through their good life and conversation. Okay, so we're going to re-talk about that. We also can see here, this is the seal of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And what is the Native American, there's a little, you know, bubble or whatever you want to call it, the banner coming out of its mouth. What does it say? Okay, allusion to? Yeah, the Macedonian call, come over and help us. So that was, so what we are seeing is we are seeing a intention being given to really be actively involved in the conversion of the native population in the New World by both Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay Colonies. Both of them are going there. What we are also going to find out is that there was a big, big, big gap between what they said their intention was and what actually happened. In fact, many of the Puritans themselves in New England or in England are going to bring this issue up. John Robinson, you know, he was one of the separatists that went with the group, the group that came and became the Plymouth Colony. He ended up staying in Leiden in the Netherlands, did not go with that first group. He is going to say, oh, that you had converted some before you killed any. And Solomon Stoddard, he is the grandfather of Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards served as co-pastor with him at the end of Solomon Stoddard's life. He is going to publish a tract called, they used to have these really long titles of tracts or books, so you know exactly what the book is about by just reading its title. Whether God is not angry with the country for doing so little towards the conversion of the Indians. So Puritans themselves realized that what they said they were going to do was really not getting done the way they had said that it would be. And so how are we going to understand this? What are some of the reasons for this basic lack of Indian evangelization going on? Well, let me just put something out there in general first anyway. And that is that there was a convention in this colonization literature to always give Indian evangelization as one of the reasons why you're doing it. Now, this is going to go back. Thomas Gates, the governor of Virginia, he's going to do it. It's not just the Puritans. All of them are going to say the reason we're doing this is to convert the native population. And, you know, and in some ways, frankly, these statements were meant to justify the dispossession or taking of Indian land. Even John Cotton is going to write, Puritan John Cotton, as you partake in their land, so make them partakers in your precious faith. As you reap their temporals, their land, so feed them your spirituals. So, you know, it was viewed as winning them to faith, was viewed as, in a sense, a way of justifying taking their land. So, reality, however, as to what the real motivation for coming is. Richard Cogley, he is a Puritan scholar, okay? So he's sympathetic to Puritans. So this is not a negative view coming here. He is going to look at all the evidence, and he is basically going to say that the immigrants, in spite of their statements of intention to reach the native populations, were actually really concerned with establishing a civil and a church government that was built upon the Word of God, and that would be an example to Old England of how it ought to be done. They wanted to be, everyone, I'm sure some of you have read John Winthrop's City on the Hill sermon. They wanted to be a beacon light of what it means to be, to set up the right church and state government. And so that's really what they were about. Okay, and that's really where their energy is going to go. And Cogley and Dwight Bozeman, another Puritan scholar, is going to say that there were, after those initial statements about the importance of Indian evangelization, there were almost no other statements about it being important in the first generation. And so that's part of the explanation of why it didn't happen the way they said it was supposed to happen. Well, there's some other reasons. This, for the class that is taking this, one big theme is your theology makes a huge difference as to what you do or don't do with regard to missions. Okay? Huge difference. And that's going to be an issue. And John Cotton was convinced, as were many others, not the only, but he is going to be very influential in the New England colonies. And he is going to state that the conversion of the Indians would only occur after a wide-scale Jewish conversion. He's going to take these from the book of Revelation. He's going to, of course, believe that Roman Catholicism is the Antichrist. First, the Antichrist would be destroyed at the Battle of Armageddon. Then the Jews would be converted. And only then could you expect an influx of Gentile believers. Okay? And he, of course, is going to go on the assumption that the Native Americans were Gentiles. Okay? So that's kind of this is the Jews before Gentiles sequence thing, all right? Now, this is not kind of eschatology or theology we tend to talk about, but this, you can obviously see, is demotivating to missions. If you don't expect, here you're trying to get your church and civil government set up, here you have this open arena. Well, it's not open because Indians used to live here. But, you know, basically you have this blank slate where you can set up your government the way you want to. And, you know, you have other things on your plate anyway. And when you have this theology that is basically demotivating to being involved in missions, it's not too surprising that not much was done. Okay, well, actually, there's going to be a change, and this is going to be Richard Cogley. If you're interested in knowing more in detail, extreme detail, about John Eliot and his mission to the Native Americans, Richard Cogley's book on this is very good, and he is trying to rehabilitate it. There are, of course, some who view John Eliot very negatively as annihilating the culture of his converts. But anyway, that's not the approach Cogley is taking. What I was going to say is, in this book, he very clearly outlines that John Eliot is going to adapt or change from the typical John Cotton approach to eschatology. He is going to view the Native peoples as part of the 10 lost tribes. And he's going to hold this view for about 15 years. And then actually he's going to go back to the John Cotton view. But anyway, in this period of time, this is going to be more motivating to do mission. Because here they're part of this Jewish, so you can expect them actually more likely to come to faith than in the other scheme. So anyway, that is going to be another example of theology making a difference. Yes?
Just real quick on Cotton's view. It seemed like Zinzendorf had a similar view.
He did.
That they could only expect the first fruits.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute.
It was motivating. Which struck me. It's almost like they went to the field with a confidence that they don't need to worry about results.
That's definitely true. We will get in more detail in that at a later time. Well, there were other reasons for the lack of Indian evangelization, and one key thing was the barrier of the Indian languages. They had naively thought, oh well, no big deal, learn these. Well, these are not easy languages, okay? And most of them are some form of the Algonquin. They're the different, the Wampanoag Indians were in that area of the Plymouth colony and so forth. But and they spoke a form of Algonquin. But actually, in the first decades, we only know of a few, like literal handful, like three or five Puritans that actually were able to learn, who actually learned the Indian languages. So that is another aspect, the difficulty of it. And in the congregational polity in New England, there was no provision for full support given to a missionary. John Eliot and Thomas Mayhew, we have two individual, David Brainerd, by the way, is a whole century later, so he could be viewed as Puritan too, but he's way later. In this period of time, we only have two people that we can point to, two individuals, and they both had to have a full-time pastorate. So what they were doing among the, that was how they earned their money, in a sense. And so what they did with the Indians among the native peoples is really moonlighting, you could say. And obviously, you don't have as much time or energy when you have a whole church that you are responsible to. So, but that's how the congregational polity was at that time. Moving on, what were some of John Eliot's mission methods? Well, he used what Richard Cogley defines as the effective model. Now, if you remember what I read out loud from the Massachusetts Bay Charter, they wanted to win and incite the natives to the Christian faith through your good life and orderly conversation. So basically, the idea was, a little naive, but that if we just lived a holy life in front of them, they would desire to become Christians. That they would see this lifestyle and want to become one. Now, actually, the reality is only maybe a half a dozen did decide to in this first period, and we know that because John Eliot wrote reports. So by the 1640s, there was about a half a dozen. So basically, this was not very successful. And it implies, or some historians have pointed out, that there is almost inherent ethnocentricity. In other words, somewhat of an idea that if the Indians would just look upon the English lifestyle, that they would want it in and of themselves. Well, that's kind of implying that their lifestyle, you know, irrespective even of a religion, is second rate. Well, like I said, this was not very successful. What is going to also, we're going to have other aspects that are part of his approach. One was, he did go on and learn well the Algonquin language. He's ultimately going to translate the scriptures into it. He is going to have very clear proclamation evangelism. He is going to do it like he did it in a Puritan church in New England. You preach for an hour and a half, you know. Now, he would do it in Algonquin after he learned it. In the beginning, he would have a translator, but pretty soon he was preaching. It would be heavy doctrinal meat. And well, one thing he did do, he is going to use contextual examples. For instance, he will liken punishment in hell to the torture of captives. That would be relevant to the native populations. They were all aware that this went on between the various people groups. The church ordinances to a fort, like a place of safety. Regeneration to the cleansing of filthy pipes. You know, so these were illustrations that would make sense to their lifestyle, but it was heavy doctrinal teaching. Now, this is not just John Eliot, but in general, there was a belief that it was not possible for Native peoples to become Christians without being civilized first. What they meant by civilized, they had to give up a nomadic lifestyle. They had to settle and farm, basically, and so forth. That, John Eliot is first going to say, first civilize the natives and then bring that some of them to know God. Eliot is further going to say, Indians are incapable of making progress in the Christian life whilst they live so unfixed, confused, and ungoverned a life, uncivilized and unsubdued to labor and order. So that was part of it. There are other things. That part of this civilization is there were certain things that about their culture that were offensive to at least the white English population. For instance, things like you may not pick your lice and eat them, but you know, different things like this, that they could not hoot and holler. You know, they used to do howling and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And there was a number of rules and so forth that were connected. A lot of it connected with grooming, their grooming and so forth. Now, so this was a preconception shared by John Winthrop, shared by a number of people at this time. And that is going to actually, to be honest, cause a lot of controversy with regard to this mission approach by modern scholars today, you can imagine. And so that's going to be one thing. The other is, we already talked about proclamation, instruction in the Puritan faith. There is an assumption that if, you know, they would of their own accord recognize that their heathen practices were wrong and would give them up. So this would be this part. So there are various stages in terms of really becoming a convert. The third one was conversion. I already said that this is viewed as a long process generally. Eliot would report, and actually David Brainerd would as well, about the tears of repentance by the Indians when they're being preached to. Now, we would think, wow, they've repented, this is great, they've become Christians. They didn't view that that was a sign of conversion. That was only a sign that God might have begun to work in their life. So they had a higher bar than many of us would place for conversion than they did. They had a higher bar than we would. Same thing true with church membership. Now I will say, on one hand, this is the same rules that they used for the white congregations as well, but which were stringent, okay? This is going to mean that you're not only going to have to pass an oral exam in Christian doctrine, but you would have to be able to give a convincing conversion narrative, and not just that, You need to have a life where that all the others would be examining your behavior and see if you show fruits of repentance. So this was the approach for both the English and the native congregations. This is obviously going to lead to a long delay. Henry Knapp of Calvin Seminary, so he's coming from a positive view. You know, there's plenty of people that have negative views of this mission. He's coming from a positive view, but he is even admitting that this long delay also had an element of racism connected with it. That, in other words, that it wasn't just that they weren't far enough. And this was, by the way, very, very discouraging to John Eliot when his believers were not being recognized as such. And so that's one aspect there. Let's go on to a further aspect of his mission methods. The most controversial are his formation of praying towns. Most famous at Natick, Massachusetts. There were ended up being 14 of these. And people joined them voluntarily. This is not like there are some reductions of the Jesuits and of the Franciscan and Dominicans of Latin America that were not fully voluntary. This was voluntary, but of course you, on the one hand, they felt that this would give the native peoples an opportunity to be in a Christian environment to accommodate, you know, to a Christian lifestyle, and so forth. But obviously, what's the downside of this?
Isolation from others who don't know the Lord.
Yes, you are isolating yourself from your natural contacts that you could lead to Christ, okay? For the sake of you know, separation or a holier life. Now, these obviously were viewed as putting them in an environment where they could live more civilized there. If you lived in the praying towns, as I said, it was voluntary. You had to be willing to go by their rules, which means about hygiene, work habits, sexuality, your hairstyle, and so forth. There were fines for Sabbath breaking, beating, wife beating, bad grooming, and all that kind of stuff. So that was one aspect of it. One other aspect of it is not, John Eliot was looking to Exodus 18 for his model. This is where Jethro commands Moses to set up rulers of tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands. And so this is what his plan was, to try to do that in these praying towns. So this wasn't supposed to be an English model. This was supposed to be a biblical model. And that was his intention. This is voluntary, and there were reasons why native peoples wanted to live there. Anyone guess what some of them might be? Yeah, that could be related to the fact that there were some who desired either English goods or they desired the skills to learn how to be a carpenter or whatever. If you lived in one of these towns, you could learn English skills. Yes? Possibly. I don't know that there was a lot of persecution going on from others, but that one thing, it was a more secure place to live, but that was often not as a thing because of persecution, but because of rivalries between various people's groups, tribal groups, whatever you want to call them. So there was that going on, yes, as well. One, the main reason is people desired literacy. They wanted to learn to read. And that was really a huge motivation. Well, John Eliot is going to concentrate on the sachems, which were the chiefs. And actually, this approach is going to not be very effective. He's going to admit that the sachems of the country are generally set against us. So they resisted it. And so it really proved to be less effective. What he did best was translation work. This Bible here is the first printed Bible from printed in the New World and in the Algonquin language. He also is going to make translations of the catechism, of a grammar, and so forth. Other positive thing is developing of indigenous leadership. By the way, he has a full-time job doing something else. So he very quickly put into place Indian evangelists who are going to be going, who he is going to trust to evangelize as well as to do teaching. He's going to, there's going to be the first Indian minister ordained at Natick. And now some of this, I think Eliot's heart was to have this more developed than it was able to. You know, he had to work in conjunction with this congregational church polity, and they tended to drag their feet. You know, there was some frustration there. I'm going to move quickly to actually a missionary who's known less than John Eliot. The reason we know about John Eliot is because he is going to write these little books called First Fruits of New England. He's going to have a whole bunch. He's going to have a lot of literature connected to the mission work. And so he's going to be more known because of that. The better of the two missionaries, however, was Thomas Mayhew. Thomas Mayhew was an interesting guy. That's junior. There's a senior. I'm talking junior. Senior, same name, basically in 1641, so that's early. 1630 was the founding of Massachusetts Bay. 1641, Mayhew Senior got permission to settle, to colonize Martha's Vineyard, proprietor, you know, Big Island off of Cape Cod. Well, anyway, he and 50 settlers settled there, and there were about 3,000 Wampanoag. So they're living in close contact with native peoples. That's a big difference. They're going to have a big difference between the experience of John Eliot, for example. Okay, he was also a congregational minister. He had to, you know, earn a living. So that's what he did. But he was very committed early along to the Indian mission there. And he is going to lead this one convert in 1643. He's only 22 years old at that time. He Acomas, and he actually is going to really use He Acomas in many ways. He's going to be the one that had taught him to speak like a native, taught him the local Algonquin dialect. He's going to be an evangelist. He's going to be the first ordained person, native clergy on Martha's Vineyard. He was more successful than Eliot, basically, because he was more tolerant of native culture. He lived among them. All right, let me tell you what you don't run into. You don't run into this kind of diatribe against picking lice or grooming or their lustfulness or their laziness. You don't hear this kind of language going on from Thomas Mayhew, okay? He lived among them. He appreciated their culture much more. It wasn't being filtered through an English lens so much of what it ought to be. And obviously their lifestyle doesn't look that much like an English lifestyle. So you're not seeing any of that. He is not going to concentrate on the sachems, the chiefs. He's going to concentrate on the shamans, the witch doctors, the powwows. And basically because those are the ones that hold the power in the community. They're the ones that are holding the people firmly to these heathen beliefs. So I mentioned very briefly before that he is going to challenge them. He is going to, when it just sort of happened, a sick native person came to him. He had gone to one of the powwows, hadn't been healed, come to Mayhew. Mayhew prays for him. He, in the name of Christ, and he recovers. Here is Mayhew's account of it. And so when I had, by reasoning with him, convinced him of the weakness of the powwow's power, and if help were to be found, it must be had from him who gave life, I commended his case unto the Lord, whereof he rejoiced, gave me thanks, and he speedily recovered unto his former strength. Well, not too surprisingly, this is going to make it through the through this community of native peoples. This is going to lead to some significant conversions of chiefs. There's going to be other power encounters. They had a stand down, or whatever you want to call it. He had Hiakomas stand up against them. The powwow was being accused of, through cursing, killing people, having the power to kill. And so Hiakomas challenged him, won the challenge. Several of the powwows came to faith. That's going to be a huge breakthrough in the community. So by the time, Junior, he died young. He got lost at sea going over to England. His father and his son are going to take over the mission. So it's going to be kind of a Mayhew family thing. So it's not going to be a major mission, but it is going to be a piece there of it. So he was definitely much more successful. When he died, he had a flourishing church at Martha's Vineyard. All right, I got 15 minutes for pietism, and actually they did the more work in this era. So I was going to spend time defining what pietism is. Let me just give you the one line and skip some of this because I got to move on. The one line is, or does somebody else want to give me the one line?
Take a shot. It's a reaction against the anti-Orthodoxy.
Yes. In what church? German Lutheran Church. Very good. I am very happy to see that. Very often, pietism, because of our mix-up of the word piety and pietism, is misunderstood to be a form of spirituality that is present in every era of the Christian church. I would say nay to that. I wrote my dissertation on pietism, so I have strong feelings about this one. So it is actually going to be a specific thing, a reaction about 150 years after the Protestant Reformation in Germany, against a dead form of orthodoxy. They are going to, sometimes the pendulum swings too far in one direction. It had gone too far toward an intellectualized faith, okay? Where basically I'm justified by faith because I believe the Augsburg Confession. And so the pietists are going to be the ones who swing it back to where it ought to be, probably went too far the other direction a little bit. But they're going to emphasize regeneration, importance of a holy life. You cannot count on your justification by faith. You have to live a life worthy of Christ. Heart religion, that you have to love God emotionally. This is going to be a little bit of a reflection of the Baroque era, which is coming about at this time. Small group Bible study. Philip Jakob Spener, he developed the small group Bible study. Okay? First one in his parsonage in Frankfurt, 1670. And so, something we hold dear was invented by these guys. And priesthood of all believers, that you can trust your lay people to lead. And evangelism and missions. They're going to be different from many of the Lutheran Orthodox and believe that the Great Commission actually does apply to us. So that is going to be a thing. All right, I'm going to talk about two specific examples. One are from the so-called branch of pietism called holopietism. These are followers of this guy here, August Hermann Franke. He became a pastor and a professor of theology at the newly formed University of Halle, which is in eastern Germany. And it was while he's there, he's going to do all sorts of things. He is going to set up a school for all ages of children. He is going to set up a missionary training school for Oriental languages, create a Bible society. He wanted a penny Bible in every person's hand. So he's going to be the first guy that really is going to invent the old Bible society. He's going to get a Berlin nobleman to fund this. And so he is going to do very much for them. Well, anyway, what about foreign missions in him? Very activist type people, by the way, doing things for God, busy for God. Well, just briefly, he was influenced by the German philosopher and mathematician Gottfried Leibniz, who had written a book, he did other things, but he had written a book about the Jesuit mission in China. News from China is the translation of the title. Franco read it, and that just really resonated with him. He, partly through that and some other influences, decided that he wanted to be actively involved in spreading what he called true Christianity. In other words, truly regenerated, born-again, Christianity worldwide. They always made that distinction between true Christianity and what we would call nominal. Part of it was this College of Oriental Studies at Halle to support missions in Asia, all kinds of various languages. He is another thing. I will have another slide on the Danish Halle mission that he is going to be involved with. So I'll talk about that in a second. One other huge piece that he's going to do, he's going to have the first Protestant missions newsletter publication. And by the way, let me just tell you something. There was no TV, radio, other things. This was totally fascinating stuff. People loved reading about other countries because many of them might not have traveled more than 25 miles in their entire life. And so this was really fascinating stuff. We're going to see the journals of Captain Cook are going to, even though he was totally secular, are going to do more for the cause of missions than just about anything, because it's going to put the world in their mind. And so that's going to be, so basically he's going to invent the first Protestant missionary magazine, and this is going to lead to a huge explosion of interest in missions. Also, he's going to cooperate with the English Society for the Promotion of Christian Knowledge. There's going to be key Halle pietists involved with that. He's also going to provide German missionary pastors to North America. You know, they just missed it by about one vote as to whether or not English or German would be spoken in the colonies. There was lots of Germans in there. And actually, one of the most famous, of course, is Heinrich Melchior Muhlenberg, who left Halle, and we know him for Muhlenberg College, yeah, and so forth. So a lot of those were involved. But let's talk about this Danish Halle mission. This is the first major mission, okay? When we had John Eliot, it's one individual doing something. When we had Mayhew, okay, you had a little bit of a family clan doing something, but it's a small group. The Danish Halle mission is going to last for over 100 years and have hundreds of people involved in it, or over 100 people involved in it. Hundreds is too much. But basically, how did this come about? Well, there was a Danish king, Friedrich IV. He had a colony on the southeast coast of India called Tranquilbar. And he was influenced by Pietism. And so he didn't know of any Danish theologians that he felt were properly regenerated and ready, born again, able to go and evangelize. He wanted to evangelize the Tamil people, not just be in that area. So he is going to turn to August Hermann Franke and ask him if he had anybody he could recommend. Well, Franke did. And so there were two missionaries. The most famous is Bartholomaeus Siegenbalg, who is going to go in 1705, actually arrived 1706, in India, in Tranquilbar. Now, he was educated at Halle, and many of these people in this age, boy, they already were fluent in Greek, Hebrew, and Latin, probably English and French as well, and of course his native German. So these people were really linguists of a really high caliber. Anyway, so he is going to be very key, very involved in translation work, ethnological work. He was very gifted. He was going to translate the scriptures into Tamil. Here is his signature. We have writing in Tamil and then in Latin below it. And there we have Hala, the 29th of October, 1715. He's also going to write a key work on, he talked, had a lot of conversations with Hindus, came to understand the Tamil culture and religion, is going to write a work. Now, Franck is going to say, wait a minute, what are we doing? Why are you wasting your time doing this? So actually, it didn't get published until around 1910. He wrote it 200 years before that. One other key thing, he's going to be involved in educational ministry. He's going to believe that this is the way that we can reach the people is through reaching young people before they're so set in their cultural ways, I suppose you would say. And so he's going to follow the model. Remember, Hala had a whole slew of schools. He's going to follow the Hala model in India and have charity schools and all sorts of levels of schools up to university and theological seminaries. And involved in evangelism and church planting within 5 years of arriving, there's a statue of Ziegenbalg there. He had founded the New Jerusalem Church. That's in front of the, that building is the original building, that white one. And they had 202 members, and he did not baptize easily. So that was a great success. All right, just because I want to, because I want to skip to Zinzendorf, I'm just going to have to skip this slide, because he is very important. The one thing I just want to do, want to go up one last thing, is that this mission, the last one, this is the first Protestant mission in a non-Christian land, and this is 85 years before William Carey. So there is, you know, some could cogently argue that there is a degree of English language ethnocentricity that we view William Carey as the founder of modern missions, when really these guys were Protestants and doing a great job before that. But I think there's other things that we could argue of why William Carey deserves his place. But that's another talk another day. Okay, Zinzendorf. Well, he's a count, of course. He's high nobility, all right? He also is going to have studied at Hala. So he's going to know this Hala. He's going to know, he's going to grow up there and experience firsthand their desire for missions. He's going to imbibe that. But he's actually going to react against this, what he viewed to be a very negative kind of view of conversion. Basically, their spirituality, they had this belief that you were really only truly converted if you went through this long repentance struggle concept. And he reacted against that and is going to reject that. He will be known for reinstituting the Moravian Church. These are the descendants of the Unitas Fratrum, you know, the Hussites from Moravia, as well as other Protestant refugees formed a community there at Ehrenhut, which means the Lord's Watch. A revival is going to break out there in 1727. Now, they are going to divide their whole community. Pietist emphasis on small groups, small group Bible study. That is Pietism, okay? He is a Pietist. Moravians are one branch of the Pietist movement. He is going to divide his entire community into groups. You are going to have the single sisters, the single brothers, the married sisters, the boys choir, the girls choir. They called them choirs, these groups. They had nothing to do with music. It's just a translation of chor in German. And so that's going to be one key element. They also are going to use the lot for important decisions. They believe that our own, now you've got to read what Sinzendorf himself says about this. He believes that we are so unable to distance ourselves and really experience wisdom that he felt that for some important decisions, using the lot was a way to allow God's decision, God's will to be done. Now, what did you use it for, though? You used it for who you might marry. It wouldn't tell you who to marry, but if you could submit it to the lot and you would get yes, no, or wait as the answer. So you could, it would be who would go to the mission field and who would be elders in the community. So yeah, that's a little unique. There is an emphasis that got a little bit morbid. They've retoned it down. It had a period of time. Emphasis on Christ crucified to the extent that it got a little bit morbid at one era. But what we really know them for is a very strong emphasis on missions. Anyone know how they got into interest in missions?
Was it through a slave from
St. Thomas? Yes, he was. Actually, what happened is Sinzendorf, by nobility, he was invited to the coronation of the Danish king. Okay, you know, that's the circles he traveled in. And so he met this Anthony Ulrich, who was a slave from St. Thomas, and this just totally, you know, captivated him. Anthony was saying that he wanted missionaries to be brought. He had become a Christian. His master had brought him to Denmark, and he had become a Christian, and he wanted his family and relatives to hear about Christ. So this was in 1731, 1732. The first Moravian missionaries, Leonhard Dober and David Nietzschmann, are going to go to St. Thomas. By the way, they went and received no financial support. They were generally lay people who are going to earn their own living. In this case, they worked alongside the slaves that they were ministering to on St. Thomas. Large numbers of them died due to malaria and other diseases. And so 1632 St. Thomas, the first people, 1732, 1733, first missionaries in Greenland, 1734 in Lapland, in 1734 also in Georgia. That's where Wesley came into play there, contact with the Moravians there. Suriname by 1735, South Africa 1736, Ceylon, you know, one country after another. This is really quite an amazing thing. What is going to be unique about them is they are going to say a heart for Jesus is adequate. They are going to, we didn't get to talk about it, but the Danish Hall of Missionary is going to have only ordained Lutheran pastors, well-educated, and so forth. They are going to say any tinker or tailor or carpenter who has a heart for God can go. Of course, you had to work for your own living when you went there. But they had they would live, of course, in close contact with the people. And because of that, they were independent of colonial powers. Sinzendorf, the whole spirituality of the Moravians was very Christocentric, cross-centered. They would preach Christ crucified. Keep the message simple. We are going to, you know, you're not going to get into big theological arguments as to how God created the universe in 7 days or whatever. You don't start there. You appeal, in a sense, to you appeal to Christ and his dying, his love for you, your forgiveness of sins. So they kept it simple that way. And they believed that God had prepared, just as he had prepared Cornelius in Acts 10 for the message. God had prepared his small group of people who would convert. So the missionary only needed to quietly knock on their heart's door, and those who were called by Christ would convert. So basically, unlike some of the hollow point of view, where you they have this high view, again, more similar to the Puritan view of conversion, needing a long period of time before baptism, they're going to say, that's not necessary. You've converted. You can get baptized. Last thing that's important about them, and this was already mentioned, is there are two theological concepts that had a big influence on their mission work. One was they viewed themselves as a pilgrim church. All right, background to this is Count Zinzendorf was basically kicked out of Saxony, okay? Now, he had wisely turned over all his property into the name of his wife, so he actually didn't lose the property in Herrnhut and elsewhere. But basically, this event caused him to view himself as being on mission, a pilgrim church. We are, you know, anywhere in the world. So they're going to have several communal colonies that are going to be specifically viewed as existing for the sake of mission. 25%, get that? 25% of Moravians went to the mission field, foreign mission field. Now, there is no other denomination that came anywhere close to that. And that's why here I'm ending with them, but we've got to talk about the Moravians, because they did something nobody else had done to this time. They and it's really, really, really quite significant. So, there are going to be in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. They had a Moravian colony. It was there. People, young men, intentionally remained celibate, remained single, so they could go into the mission field. They often felt that it was too hard for women to go. So this was a commitment to mission in a big way. The remainder of the community is going to work and pray. If God, they were ready, and literally at the drop of the hat, or the roll of the dice, it wasn't a dice with their lot, you know, to go on mission. So it was like, all of us are ready to go whenever God calls us. So that is unique. Second unique thing is they are going to have, very similar to this John Cotton view, they're also going to believe that there is not going to be a large-scale conversion of the Gentiles until there's a full ingathering of the Jews. So basically, you could only expect, and John Cotton's also going to use the first fruits terminology, but it's obviously much more famous in connection with the Moravians. You could only expect first fruits to come to faith, okay? Individual souls. And so this is going to be the way they're going to view it. He is actually going to have an interesting little twist that I wasn't aware of until recently in reading some of his sermons. I ran across the fact that he was attempting, as a Lutheran, to try to, or, I mean, he's now Moravian, but he's Lutheran background, to reconcile this concept of free will and election. And he is going to come to this somewhat unique view that the first fruits are the elect, and other people who are saved are then just accept Christ, in a sense. It's a little unique. Nobody else came up with this one, but oh well. Anyway, first fruits, this is a very key thing. This picture here, it was painted in 1747, so lifetime of Zinzendorf, okay? 15 years after their mission, this is showing Christ surrounded by the first fruits of the Moravian missions. And what is interesting is there is a name for every one of them, including the children. The man standing there in the black suit is Andreas from, he was an elder on the island of St. Thomas. He was one of the first fruits of their mission in St. Thomas. basically they have in this picture the first fruits from their various mission fields on this painting. So it's very interesting, and they're not just any old buddy. They know who they are, they have a name and a biography connected with them that the Moravians are new. Final statement, by the way, they led so many people to the Lord that by 1760 they gave up the first fruits theology. They said, obviously, the Lord wants to save more than we were thinking. You know, so they basically thought, well, that must be wrong. So, you know, Sinzendorf is going to say, I only asked for the first fruits among the heathen, and 1,000 have been granted me. You know, what a caravan there must now be before the throne of the Lamb. So anyway, let's open it. We got 10 minutes for questions. That's a zip through Pietist and Puritan missions. Yes.
So the Puritans, were they post-millennialists? They didn't think that Gentile would become Christ until after there was war.
I don't exactly know. There are Puritans that are both pre-mill and post-mill. Jonathan Edwards is post-mill. I don't exactly know what he has to say. I'm sure I've read it, but I don't want to say it wrong, so I don't know for sure. Well, post-millennial are sort of amillennial too, because the millennium, you know, it's not really
right.
A millennium per se. It's not a, you know, it's happening now in this present church age. So, yeah. There's really what happens is we like to use post-mill, pre-mill, amill, but basically there are so many varieties of eschatology that they really don't all fit quite as neatly in those three categories. As we like to say. Any other questions? Yes?
It's a kind of specific question, but you mentioned Puritans making national covenants. Would that just be like, we initiate this covenant and we've decided our end of the bargain and now we will tell God his end of the bargain? Or, I mean, who initiates that sort of covenant? Or what form might that kind of covenant?
Well, it's sort of like, you know, that reverse, you know, if my people were called by my name, will humble themselves. It's sort of that idea that they took, that they believed that they, as a community, not as a church, an individual church, which they covenanted together, but as a larger community, were in covenant with God. Yes, they probably did, you know, they felt that they would call from the scriptures what God expected of them. And basically viewed often national calamities as a sign of God's disfavor, as his judgment against them. And often those would lead to days of prayer and fasting to discover where they had failed or sinned. So, yeah. Other questions? About the Moravians, or
how long did their mission sending last?
Who are you speaking of?
The Moravians. We talked about the 100-year prayer meeting, things like that. But how long did the missions, the sending missionaries, from that?
Well, they still send them today. Actually, the Moravian Church is much bigger overseas than it is at all in the United States. You know, they have in South Africa and other places a significant church, whereas in most places in the Western world, less so. So in some ways, they still send missionaries, and it would probably be sending from side to side in that regard. Yeah. Because they're an existing denomination, of course, today.
By
no, that died out quite early. That died out, quite early. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I guess it's more of a comment. I'm just wondering with the first fruits theology, it would seem that it would cause them to want to pool back a little bit on mass conversions and that their passion for many people coming to Christ. But it's interesting that their methods actually made it easier than those who had come before them.
That's true.
By simplifying the conversion process and all those things. And so it's a little bit of a, I'm just trying to reconcile my mind how those two things kind of fit together, because it seems like they would want to contain almost the number of conversions because of this theology, and yet they simplified the conversion process.
Yeah, it is because you were right. They have a very similar theology as John Cotton did, which did demotivate mission and actually hindered mission. It didn't hinder Sinzendorf and the Moravians. You could view their faith as quite simplistic. Love for the Savior, love for the Lamb. Those are the words they use. But a real heart to reach others, in spite of the fact that, yes, as you pointed out, there might be less pressure put upon them. If God hasn't, God doesn't do it, then they had no problem if, for instance, they went to Ceylon, Sri Lanka now, but they went to Ceylon. The mission didn't advance. They had no problem pulling back. It was just like, okay, God hasn't prepared for Cornelius for us. First fruits like a Cornelius. So they would go, in other words, they could test the waters and leave, and by this no bureaucracy. You just send them out and they live on their own. You could send, you didn't need, huge finances and bureaucracy. You just did it. It was really quite phenomenal. If you are going to compare what is done when we talk today about Puritan and the Pietists by far overrule in terms of the number of individuals involved and the results achieved in terms of missions. So they're really the ones. We'll go here and here. Okay.
Yeah, just to comment on what you just said, it seems that the Pietists, there's not those national political kind of underlying motives mixing in there as
right.
Puritans.
Right. There isn't. And they're going as, they're not a state church. They're just in an era when most Europeans were connected with some kind of state church. And so, they're just going as lay people, as tradesmen, or as carpenters or whatever they were. And where else I see a hand? Yes.
I was going to say something similar. It seems like their self-view of their identity is much different. They have a lot less attachments to home country, and it's much less inward. You see, like, Puritans and people, I haven't heard a lot, but there's less, like, light on a hill and more, let's go do something.
Yeah.
So even though they have some similar theology, they also have massive differences.
There's massive differences. There really are massive differences. You are right. And particularly this whole pilgrim concept, as I said, it was probably partially pushed that way because Sinzendorf got kicked out of Saxony. But on the other hand, he took that as an opportunity to reconfigure their community around missions, and so it's quite a unique moment in missions history. Yes.
How aware were the Moravians of missions history? Because I'm thinking maybe one thing that makes it easier to just cut loose and just go somewhere is if you don't have baggage around the notion of being a missionary, going somewhere, trying to reach people and start a new work of God or something like that. Maybe it wouldn't seem like as big of a deal if you just felt like, I'm just going to go and see if I can but if they had, a stronger sense of missions history and people doing this kind of thing on purpose with the backing of, state or something like that. I'm just trying to figure out how they thought of themselves. Was it, I'm a missionary as a representative of just this community. I'm a missionary truly for, a lot of spiritual reasons.
Well, the Moravians, Sinzendorf himself, met Siegenbaum. He was aware of what Holland's doing. Halle is really, and they would have heard about the small efforts in the New World, you know. So, I mean, yes, they would have known those. Now, they probably wouldn't have even counted what was going on in the Roman Catholic world. Well, I can't say that totally, because actually, Franke was quite, when he read Leibniz's, report about the Jesuit mission in China, that spurred him. So, yes, I would say there would have been some awareness of these modern efforts. And what was basically, you know, the Pietists are going to break away, and this will have to be my last because it's already five, break away from this typical Lutheran Orthodox view that the Great Commission has already been fulfilled. You see, that piece of the, theological puzzle has to be in place. What you think about the Great Commission is real important to whether or not you do anything. So, okay, well, thank you for coming and have a good dinner.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.